Stay tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org. We do have Democracy Now! Coming up at the top of the hour, as per usual, at 8 o'clock. Followed by This Way Out, lesbian, gay, transgendered news. Also, Counterspin will be at 9:30, followed by Counterspin. And then I'll be back in here with Operation Ear Infection Show, bringing you brand new music. Stuff not even released yet at 10 o'clock. So stay tuned. Right now, we're going to start off with the Al Jazeera English news. And then we're going to get into some other news services as well. So stay tuned for that, getting an early start on the news this morning. Stay tuned.
Shabab fighters in Somalia are vowing to retaliate without mercy for a U.S. helicopter attack which killed an Al-Qaeda bomb suspect. The Somali government says Saleh Ali Saleh Nabhan died along with four other fighters while driving through Barawi district. Nabhan was wanted for trying to shoot down an Israeli passenger jet and for the deadly bombing of a hotel in Kenya 7 years ago. From the capital Nairobi, Andrew Simmons reports.
It was an attack that must have relied upon pinpoint intelligence. Sources have confirmed that special forces on board helicopters from a U.S. warship crossed into southern Somalia in a region controlled by the Islamist group Al-Shabaab. The reported target, this man, Saleh Ali Saleh Nabhan, Kenyan-born and one of the FBI's most wanted. He was wanted for alleged involvement in the bombing of an Israeli-owned hotel in Mombasa, Kenya in 2002. And for a simultaneous surface-to-air rocket attack on an Israeli passenger jet taking off from Mombasa Airport. Those rockets narrowly missed their target. The truck that crashed into the lobby of Paradise Hotel did not. 15 were killed, Israeli tourists and Kenyans amongst them. Washington says that Al-Shabaab is Al-Qaeda's proxy in Somalia, but for more than 15 years, the U.S. has struggled to form a clear and consistent policy towards this country. And the cycle of violence only continues with the UN-backed government struggling for survival against the growing control of Al-Shabaab. It's reported between 4 and 6 helicopters were involved in the raid, opening fire on a convoy of vehicles. At least one of those helicopters landed, and it's thought that 2 bodies were recovered. While the US sources say they're confident they've got their target, it remains to be confirmed whether they've recovered the body. Andrew Simmons, Al Jazeera, Nairobi in Kenya.
Dia Rashwan is a political Islam analyst at the Al Ahram Center for Strategic Studies in Cairo. He explains why Somalia has been an important base for Al-Qaeda for a long time.
All the Eastern Africa countries, Somalia, Kenya, Tanzania, was from long time, from the mid of 90s, one of the fertile places for Al-Qaeda activities. And now, with the transition of the conflict to Somalia and the increasing of the crisis in Somalia, and also the increasing of the Islamic feelings and Islamic groups in Somalia, I think that now we have a very good place for Al-Qaeda as a base in this area. Of sure, the foreign participation, foreign intervention, Ethiopian or American or French or European in Somalia increased also the Islamic extreme feeling against the actual government and against the foreign intervention. And this also gave Al-Qaeda one of its, vital excuses to exist in this area. I think that Somalia now is full of all kinds of Islamists. We have Al-Qaeda's people. We have also moderate Islamists. We have even the Sufist military Islamists in Somalia.
The Iraqi journalist whose size 10 shoes suddenly became the most famous pair in the world has been released from prison. Muntada Razaidi was sentenced to 3 years for famously attacking George Bush and calling him a dog. Now the report has been released after serving just 9 months and says he's been tortured while inside. He's also been explaining why he did it, as Tariq Basley reports.
Early release for good behavior. Unsigned paperwork delayed his release by a day, but now Muntada Al-Zaidi is free. He served just 9 months of an original 3-year sentence. His crime, assaulting a foreign president. He may have upset the government, but has in the process become a national hero.
By throwing my shoes at the face of the war criminal Bush to express my denouncement of his falsehoods, denouncing the occupation against my people, gobbling our riches, destructing our infrastructure and displacing our whole people. After 6 years of killings, desecration of sanctities, the criminal murderer is standing here and expecting us to throw flowers at him. Simply, this was my flower to the occupier.
Because of the success of this.
And this, the December 2008 press conference in Baghdad. President Bush's last visit to Iraq made headlines around the world, but not for what was said. Al-Zaidi was arrested moments after hurling his shoes at the US president. He shouted, "This is your farewell kiss, you dog," from the widows, the orphans, and from those who were killed in Iraq. As a TV journalist, he had reported on the suffering of the Iraqi people following the US invasion in 2003. He saw the press conference as a final chance to express his anger. Al-Zaidi's act of defiance made him a cause célèbre in the Middle East. It sparked protests and copycat incidents around the world. A Turkish factory which claimed to have made the famous pair saw orders leap. But his protest also angered some in the Iraqi government, leading to his claim of mistreatment whilst in prison.
I was brutally and ferociously tortured. Electrification, bludgeoned by the iron rod, I was left shackled, a very cold place, soaked in water. I demand Al-Maliki to apologize for concealing the facts from the media.
Al-Zaidi's been offered a role in politics by several independent parties. But his family says he'll use his newfound status to promote humanitarian causes. His safety, though, remains a concern.
Several countries have offered to grant Muntada political asylum. Some offered him medical treatment. Muntada decided to stay and live in Iraq.
There are questions, though, as to whether he can return to work as a journalist. His channel is eager to have him back, but some suspect government officials will blacklist him. And as for the shoes, which for a short time were honoured by this monument in Tikrit before officials removed the statue, they were destroyed by investigators trying to find out if they contained explosives. Tarek Bazley, Al Jazeera.
Top-level meetings due in Turkey to try to cool rising tempers between Iraq and Syria. Iraq says it will reveal evidence that fighters linked to Al-Qaeda bombings in Baghdad came from bases in neighboring Syria. Iraq was outraged at last month's bombings, dubbed Bloody Wednesday, which killed 95 people and wounded 600 at the finance and foreign ministries in Baghdad. Turkey is acting as a peacemaker in the increasingly bitter row which caused both countries to withdraw their ambassadors.
The UN's nuclear watchdog has sworn in its new chief. Yukiya Amano of Japan has been appointed the new Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. He'll take over in December from Mohammed El-Baradei, who will step down after 12 years in office. In his last address as IAEA chief, El-Baradei called for greater transparency from Iran. He also urged nations involved in talks to pursue diplomacy over conflict.
We must keep open the channels of communication with those with whom we have issues that need to be resolved, rather than seek to isolate them. We must act within the framework of international institutions, in this case, the IAEA and the Security Council, and empower them rather than bypass them through unilateral actions. Force should never be used unless every other option has been exhausted, and then only within the bounds of international law as codified in the United Nations Charter.
Iran will start talks on October 1st with six of the world's major powers. One U.S. official described the announcement as an important first step. It comes after an offer by Iran to discuss global nuclear disarmament and other international issues. Jonah Hall has more.
They've agreed to talks, but still in question is quite what they'll be talking about. On Monday, it was decided Iran would meet the six world powers at an as yet undisclosed location on the 1st of October. The six had warned Iran it might face further sanctions unless it agreed to come to the table. Iran says the powers can ask any questions they like, but there will be no talk of curtailing its nuclear program.
It is obvious that the Iranian people will not negotiate about their undeniable nuclear rights. But as mentioned in its proposed package, definitely one of the topics is removing concerns over the nuclear issue.
The package was presented to representatives of Britain, France, Russia, China, the United States and Germany at a meeting in Tehran last Wednesday. It contained Tehran's proposal for talks, including promoting global nuclear disarmament and the right of every nation to produce nuclear energy. Iran's leaders, however, are holding firm in refusing to give up uranium enrichment, central, they insist, to fueling a nuclear energy program, equally vital, the six powers fear, for the development of a nuclear weapon.
This proposal and the acceptance of the American government to enter into negotiations suggests that, number one, the United States does not have the pulling power that it thought it had in order to encourage the Iranian regime to come to the point of negotiations regarding the nuclear issue. And number two, that the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic, has been able to hold on to its red lines, whereas the Western powers have not had any red lines despite proclaiming that they've had.
If the warning of further sanctions encouraged Iran to come to the table, it doesn't appear to have been encouraged to play a more open hand. Iran has ignored repeated United Nations Security Council ultimatums to suspend uranium enrichment, and it's been hit with three sets of UN sanctions already. The Obama administration wants to engage the Iranians to resolve the issue and has called Monday's announcement an important first step. Iran, though, considers enrichment its right. October's talks aren't likely to change that. Jonah Hull, Al Jazeera.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM.
FreakRadio.org.
U.S. Middle East envoy George Mitchell will meet the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in the coming hours. Mitchell arrived in the West Bank fresh from a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Mitchell is on a mission to persuade both sides to hold talks on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting in New York. But as Jackie Rowland explains, it hasn't been an easy task.
It's really interesting how it's so difficult to even achieve an agreement on meeting. Gives you some idea of what further negotiations might look like if we ever were to get that far. The fact that it's so difficult for a US envoy even to get the Palestinian leader and the Israeli leader to meet. And it is this whole question of a settlement freeze. The US has been pushing for this freeze as an important goodwill gesture to convince the Palestinians that they do have something to gain from going back to the negotiating table. But the Israelis don't seem willing to give the gesture of a complete freeze. They're arguing over how long this freeze should last, and they're also arguing over various exemptions. They believe that they can continue building approximately 3,000 homes in settlements in the occupied West Bank, simply on the grounds that building permits have already been granted. Now, the Palestinian side is really not impressed at all. For them, a freeze means no construction whatsoever. And at the moment, it's by no means clear at all that George Mitchell will be able to get the two sides to see eye to eye, to agree to the same kind of wording. And at the moment, it does look as though the best he can really hope for on this particular round of meetings is to try to narrow the gap between those positions.
Okay, well, let's go to Nur Eday now in Ramallah, where George Mitchell will be meeting the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. And Nur, what will Abbas be looking for from George Mitchell?
But Maryam, he'll be looking for something concrete. It's been over 15 years of negotiations and appearance of dialogue and so on. And it seems that the Palestinian leadership is extremely frustrated and very aware of the kind of bitterness the Palestinian public now have towards these meetings that have yet to yield any results. Mr. Mitchell is expected to hear an earful about the ongoing Israeli settlement activity, what that means for Palestinians on the ground, and that the appearance of a freeze is simply not good enough, because on the ground that means that it renders the two-state solution basically almost impossible. That's the consensus among Palestinian leaders, and it's a very, very popular position that the Palestinian public is supporting. It will be very difficult for the Palestinian president to appease the American administration, no matter how much he would want to do that, and say, okay, I'll meet with Benjamin Netanyahu, even though he doesn't recognize that the West Bank and East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory, even though he doesn't want to free settlements, and even though he doesn't even recognize the principle of a two-state solution. So he has a very, very tough meeting ahead of him, Maryam.
And the Palestinians, as you say, Noor, have been steadfast in their demand for Israel to stop all settlement construction, and that includes natural growth. But do they have the confidence that the U.S. is going to stand firm in continuing to pressure the Israelis to do so?
That's an excellent question. And a senior Palestinian leader told me, look, we were very optimistic, blindly optimistic, when the Obama administration came into power. We had high hopes that after just one day in power, they appointed a very credible man as their special envoy to the Middle East, Mr. George Mitchell. But it's been about 8 months, and so far, nothing has been achieved. No, not even a goodwill gesture has been reached. George Mitchell hasn't been able to convince the current right-wing Israeli government to do anything on the ground that would make our lives as a Palestinian leadership just a little bit easier. So now we're frustrated, and now we want real results. What the strategy right now, apparently, for the Palestinians is to move from asking for the resumption of negotiations to demanding that the rules of the games be set, that the international community, namely the European Union and the United States, state very clearly and unequivocally what they expect to be the end game. In other words, a Palestinian state, viable, sovereign, on the 1967 borders. No more leaving the door open to interpretation or leaving the parties to their own devices to have or iron out what the terms of the negotiations would be, which have been the rules of the game for the past decade and a half or so. And in this equation, the Palestinians are the weaker side. They are the ones occupied. They don't have much leverage. So they're using the only leverage they have, which is the ongoing Arab support, for a complete, very clear, very real Israeli freeze on settlement activity in the occupied West Bank. So far, it seems to be working, at least from a public, from a very domestic point of view. We'll see what Mr. Mitchell has to say when he comes to Ramallah later on this evening.
And I know you'll keep track of that meeting between George Mitchell and Mahmoud Abbas. Nuruddin, Ramallah, thanks. The United Nations says that Gaza's water system is on the verge of collapse. Essential water projects have been held back by the Israeli blockade, and the recent war has further damaged an already crumbling infrastructure. As Shireen Tadros reports, overworked and outdated pipelines are polluting the water and destroying people's health.
Nefis's kidneys have given up fighting. He needs dialysis every other day as his acute renal condition is getting worse. His doctors say it's because of Gaza's polluted water, which Nefis has been drinking and using for years.
The water here makes me sick, and my kidneys are so weak they can't take it. I buy bottled water as much as I can afford, but still, the fruit and vegetables too are contaminated from the dirty water.
The water situation is becoming critical. According to a new UN report, Gaza's underground water network is in danger of collapse due to overuse and contamination. Salt water from the sea is seeping into freshwater supplies, and in most of the strip, salt levels are now above the World Health Organization's guideline limit, in one case by as much as 700%. 2.5 years of Israel's blockade have delayed vital water projects by almost a decade. Essential building parts have not been allowed into the strip, so water and sanitation facilities can't be fixed, maintained, or upgraded. Israel's recent war only made the situation worse, destroying what little sewage and water infrastructure there was.
You cannot imagine that you have around 2 million people in Gaza Strip, okay, that the beach is polluted, fish is dying with us, people don't have enough water to drink, and our water is polluted. Why? Why all of that? Because of the closure, preventing so many materials to come to Gaza? This is a humanitarian issue.
The UN fact-finding mission here earlier this year concluded that unless major repairs begin now, it will take centuries and over $1 billion to reverse the damage to the water network. Meanwhile, most Palestinians here have only intermittent access to water.
The entire Gazan population relies solely on underground water for bathing, drinking, even for agricultural use. But officials are telling us only 10% of that water is actually fresh. The rest is contaminated, which means by their own prediction, in 5 years' time, there won't be a single drop of fresh water in the entire Gaza Strip.
The UN has asked Israel to open the Gaza crossings immediately and allow in necessary materials to start repairs. But the call has fallen on deaf ears, as Israel continues to deprive every person here of even the most basic of rights. Shireen Tadros, Al Jazeera, Gaza.
China is at the center of new tensions with old rival India. The world's highest peaks in the Himalayas form the world's longest disputed border, where the two Asian giants went to war more than 40 years ago. Now India is accusing China of launching incursions into the Ladakh region. Hamish McDonald sent this report from Ladakh in Indian-controlled Kashmir.
The sun rises over Kashmir. As morning reaches the tops of the Himalayas, in the monasteries they continue their ancient rituals. This is Ladakh, for centuries part of an independent kingdom, now a piece of India. There are obvious cultural connections here with China, but if you believe the latest reports, it's more than just influence that Beijing wants. The Indian military has bolstered its deployment here after the Chinese army allegedly tried to grab land in a series of air and ground incursions.
It affects the people who are living just on the border, because most of these people, they are nomads, you know. So it's a big concern for them when such a thing happens at the border.
It is a spectacular journey from Leh through the mighty Changla Pass to the border region around Pangong Lake. We've already passed about half a dozen military checkpoints. There's another just there, and we're not going to be allowed any further. The Indian military is incredibly sensitive about this issue. Where we're standing is very clearly in Indian territory, but those mountains on the other side of the lake are in China. And what makes this dispute so complicated is that there's no line of actual control. Nobody knows where India ends and where China begins. The two countries went to war over this region in 1962, and today we spot military boats still patrolling the waters. China and India share the biggest disputed border in the world. Separated by Nepal and Bhutan, it stretches from Arunachal Pradesh in the east through to Kashmir in the west. It was here, in the area near Mount Gia, on the 31st of July, that Chinese troops allegedly entered, painting the boulders red and writing China on them.
It is a disputed border. There could be navigational errors. What we think are violations have taken place, and these are resolved by talking to each other.
So India says it was probably only a mistake, and China says it never happened. But these confidential letters exchanged between senior government officials in Kashmir and obtained by Al Jazeera directly challenge what China and India are saying. Detailing incursions in December and January, the Chinese army in one instance threatened the nomads to vacate the area or face the consequences. The letters also claim that the People's Liberation Army are not even accepting it as a disputed area, but claiming it as their territory.
Now, what we can't show you, but we certainly can tell you about, is the scale of the military presence. The Indian Army won't let us anywhere near them to film, but driving between here and the border area is only about 150 kilometers. In that space, we've seen no less than 10 large-scale military bases. In one instance, we even saw a military exercise being prepared on the side of the road using heavy artillery. Even though both sides of this border dispute are playing it down, it's very clear that on the Indian side at least, it's being taken very seriously. China and India share the world's highest mountain range. Their equally lofty ambitions could someday see tensions rise. But for now, this remains a place where the shadow of China looms large. Hamish McDonald, Al Jazeera, Ladakh, Kashmir.
An Indonesian province has unanimously passed Sharia laws, including one that would see convicted adulterers stoned to death. Aceh's new legislation also imposes severe punishment for other behavior it considers morally unacceptable, such as homosexuality. The laws will take effect within 30 days. From Aceh, Al Jazeera's Step Vasan has more on the passionate debate triggered by the reforms.
A new law dividing Aceh. Protesters and supporters marched separately to the local parliament to voice their views on stricter interpretations of Sharia law. Inside the building, the lawmakers, though, were united. The new law calls for people caught having premarital sex to receive 100 strokes with a cane, and most contentiously, adulterers to be stoned to death in public. In addition, those touching each other without being married, as well as homosexuals, also face being caned. According to authorities, the changes are necessary to make Sharia more complete.
The culture in Aceh has always been Islamic. People who say these laws are against our culture don't know anything about Aceh.
Aceh has implemented partial Sharia law since 2005. Over the last 3 years, people have been caned in public, mainly for gambling offenses. And Sharia police regularly patrol the cities, looking for women who don't cover their heads and unmarried couples hanging out at the beach. Stoning people to death violates international conventions to which Indonesia is a signatory, say human rights activists, especially those concerning the use of torture.
There are much more important Sharia laws we need, for example, against corruption. Why is there no rule against corruption? Why do they only look into people's private lives?
People publicly stoning to death here in the center of Banda Aceh is still very hard to imagine. The law is there now, but the local government says it still can abolish it because it's conflicting with national laws in Indonesia. The Sharia law in Aceh has always been controversial from the start. The current leadership is not in favor, but there's a lot of pressure from Islamic groups, and the people of Aceh are divided and caught in the middle.
These young students are happy that the laws are adopted. But the vice governor in Aceh says he will try everything to have it reviewed.
We have to synchronize with the situation of the people. Aceh is different from the Middle East. Aceh is modern people.
The controversy doesn't end here. Indonesians are wondering if Aceh has become a testing ground for Sharia laws, where caning and stoning people to death become common practice, or whether this most western province will always be the exception to the rest of the country. Step Fasan, Al Jazeera, Banda Aceh.
More fighting is feared in Nigeria's oil-rich Niger Delta. A faction of the main rebel group says it's ending its ceasefire. But other leaders of the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta have asked for a 3-month extension to a government amnesty, which is due to run out at the end of the month. Unrest has cost the government billions of dollars because oil production has been slashed by 2/3. Also in Nigeria, a group of bankers are facing trial over a scandal that has rocked Africa's second biggest economy. They're accused of losing billions of dollars through reckless lending and manipulating share prices. Yvonne Ndege reports on the men who led their banks to the brink of collapse.
Executives from 5 Nigerian banks appearing in court for using billions of dollars of customer money like their own. The charges range from recklessly giving out unsecured loans to companies where they were directors, manipulating the share price of their own banks, to paying themselves gross allowances to go on holiday. The end result? A pile of bad loans totally eroding the capital base of all their banks. A $2.5 billion taxpayer bailout by the Central Bank of Nigeria saved the banks from collapse. One of their colleagues is on the run in the UK. If found guilty, these executives could spend years in prison. The scandal is rocking many of Nigeria's banks. All 24 banks are under investigation by the Central Bank of Nigeria. But it's the country's anti-corruption unit that's being charged with apprehending bank directors in their homes and offices.
If you are a managing director and you have a limit of $1 million or naira to grant loan to people, and you went ahead without any justifiable reason to grant a loan of about 30 billion naira in clear violation of the rule or of the law and of the rules of the bank, I think there is no political motivation in it. There is a crime.
Guarantee Trust Bank, one of Nigeria's most profitable, has just survived the government-backed probe into its books. The bank's chief partly blames an overheated stock market for the problem, but doesn't think tighter regulation is the answer.
During that euphoria, you know, banks also got on the bandwagon, you know, financed a lot of investment in the stock market. So when things started to correct, you know, towards the end of the year, of course, a lot of banks were caught, you know, with a substantial portfolio of non-performing loans. No regulator can stop a system, you know, that determines, you know, to self-destruct, or any institution that decides to kill itself.
So you blame your colleagues, you blame the fellow banks for what's happened to them?
Essentially, yes.
Many of the non-performing loans were given to ordinary people hoping to get rich quick on the Nigerian stock exchange. More than 20 million Nigerians bank with one of the five banks saved by the taxpayer. So it would have been political suicide for the government to allow banks to fail, given the huge number of depositors and creditors that would have lost their money. Propping up the banks with public money politically is a cheaper solution. The directors of the five banks saved from collapse have been released on bail and are awaiting trial. The results of investigations into other banks are pending. Yvonne Dege, Al Jazeera, Lagos, Nigeria.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the Queen of Caffeine, and we're educating the masses.
Out front, I'm King David McKenzie. Gay marriage supporters are moving to repeal a law that denies federal benefits to same-sex couples, but there's little chance of a vote this year. Repeal legislation to be introduced today has at least 76 House sponsors. A spokesman for the lead sponsor, Democratic Representative Gerald Nadler of New York, acknowledged that repealing the Defense of Marriage Act was not a priority for movement anytime soon. The 1996 law bars federal recognition of gay unions, including the granting of Social Security survivor payments and other government benefits to couples. The law even bars same-sex couples from receiving the benefits in states that have legalized their marriage. President Barack Obama had pledged as a candidate to work for repeal. Last month, the president insisted that he still wants to scrap what he calls the discriminatory federal marriage law, even though his administration angered gay rights activists by defending it in court. Ilan Kayatsky, spokesman for Nadler, said the repeal was being introduced now primarily to gain support and momentum and educate people. Nadler chairs a judiciary subcommittee that would consider a repeal. Representative Barney Frank, the Massachusetts Democrat and an influential openly gay lawmaker, favors repeal but is not signed on as a co-sponsor of Nadler's bill. Frank believes the legislation would have little chance of passage because it would allow for same-sex couples to take their partnership benefits across state lines, according to spokesman Harry Garau. There also has been no movement for repeal in the Senate, where it would be difficult to gain the 60 votes needed to break a filibuster. And Sir Elton John's dream of being a parent to a Ukrainian baby boy has been dealt a blow. The country's government is forbidding gay couples from adopting. John and his partner David Furnish are desperate to take the 14-month-old back to England after meeting him during a visit to an orphanage in Makiva, the Ukraine. But the couple will need the country's president, Viktor Yushchenko, to grant special dispensation to fulfill that dream of adopting Lev. John, 62, and Furnish, 46, are also facing a separate legal battle as Ukrainian law prohibits prospective parents aged over 45 years. Even if the rules are bent for John, he will also have to adopt Lev's brother, as official guidelines state siblings must be kept together. Outfront at baronofarizona@gmail.com. I'm King David McKenzie.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following comes to us from the New Republic, an interview with Obama's border czar, Alan Burstyn.
Now, the crux of this issue, essentially, is that the U.S., by consuming somewhere around $30 billion a year of Mexican drugs, is sending that money back to the cartels and fueling this war. So the question is how to reduce our consumption in this country. And I'm wondering whether you think clamping down on the border is a viable strategy.
As enforcement measures, they're necessary, but they're not an entire strategy. What fuels many events at the border is the huge consumption of drugs in this country. And until we reduce the demand for drugs, we should not expect to see the supply diminish or the organizations that try to smuggle them into the country diminish. We could do a much better job in reducing that demand, and I think the Secretary intends to lead that effort.
Well, with regards to reducing that demand, you know, there are some that believe prohibition has failed miserably over the past 100 years, that there are severe economic costs and limits to clamping down on the border, and so the only solution in the long term may actually be to legalize drugs. Is that something that you'd consider?
Yeah, this is what I call the strategy of throw up your hands and give up and come to the point where you say we're going to accept a tremendous evil and we're going to let organizations that have responsible for it actually win their purpose. I don't believe that at all. I think we have to recognize that demand reduction is an important not only because it fuels violence in Mexico and organized crime in Mexico and gangs in the United States, but because it's not good for the public health and safety of the American people. This is a long-term education effort akin to the effort that was waged against cigarettes. Our job is actually to work on demand reduction, not concede that it can't be done. And our job is also to work to contain and defeat the criminal elements that capitalize on this weakness in our society.
You know, you describe legalization as surrender, Mr. Secretary, but that's, of course, not how the folks arguing this line see it. They see it as something that could potentially decimate these cartels because Americans would no longer be buying drugs from them. And our government could potentially make a lot of money off of it through taxes, but this is something that you would never consider.
I'm certainly not there yet, and I don't think I could ever get there because there's so much more that we can do on both fronts, on both ends of this equation.
Mr. Burstyn, I see you're willing to submit to these softball questions, but when will you come on the airwaves of the Drug Truth Network? I urge you to contact me at your earliest convenience and set up an appointment for our interview. Dean@drugtruth.net.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Are you fired up?
Yeah.
Ready to go?
Yeah.
U.S. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis from the AFL-CIO's Pittsburgh Convention.
Workers are under assault, and they need a voice on the job that unions will provide. And that's why I will work with the White House so that together we make the strongest case possible for the Employee Free Choice Act.
Outgoing AFL-CIO President John Sweeney on labor's progress under his leadership.
We brought health care and labor law reform to the top of our national agenda. We seated a pro-working family majority in the United States Congress. We elected a champion of working families as the first African-American president in the history of our country.
Caroline Kennedy told AFL-CIO delegates that her family will carry on the late Senator Ted Kennedy's pro-labor work.
He believed that every worker, the nurses, the airline pilots, the teachers, the janitors, deserved to be treated with dignity and respect. He knew that the fight for workers' rights is a constant struggle. It's time to build a new economy that puts the needs of working families first. It's time to ensure that each and every American worker has a voice on the job. And it's time to pass the Employee Free Choice Act.
AFSCME President Gerald McEntee.
we're fighting back. And I want to say to you, sisters and brothers, on behalf of our great union, AFSCME, I'm here to say to you, let's put our money where our mouth is, and AFSCME pledges $500,000 more dollars to the passage of the Employee Free Choice Act.
United Steelworkers President Leo Girard pledged an extra $510,000 as he ripped up a full-page anti-Employee Free Choice Act ad in a Pittsburgh newspaper.
It's about giving us the choice we should have had. It's about giving us the choice we once had. And in honor of Senator Ted Kennedy, they can kiss my ass.
American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten.
We know the importance of a vibrant private sector where workers, not corporations, can make a real choice, a free choice, about whether they want union representation, whether they want collective bargaining, and whether they want a road to dignity, respect, and the American dream.
United Mine Workers of America President Cecil Roberts says 43% of AFL-CIO delegates this year are either women or people of color.
Get on your feet and give yourselves a round of applause. You are so far ahead of everybody else in our society.
From the AFL-CIO convention in Pittsburgh, Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News.
And you're listening to Winds on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org. Coming up on Free Radio Santa Cruz, we have Democracy Now! Waiting in the Wings. Also, This Way Out, Lesbian Gay News, following Democracy Now! At 9 o'clock. At 9:30, we have Counterspin from the Media Watch Group Fair. At 10 o'clock, I'll be back in here with Operation Ear Infection Show, bringing you new and not yet released music and views. I would like to inform folks that you now can rely on Free Radio Santa Cruz, at least for Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, to get the morning news on the air. I'll be coming back to do that as a response to all the listeners that have implored to me that they've been missing Democracy Now! Getting on time. And look today, folks, Democracy Now! Is only going to be a minute late. So stay tuned right now for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, you can rely on Free Radio Santa Cruz to get the news on between 7:30 to 8 o'clock. We'll hear Al Jazeera English, as well as Workers Independent News, 420 Drug War News, and maybe some Out Front News. That's a brand new lesbian gay news service. As well as great, great coverage from Al Jazeera English. Stay tuned right now for Democracy Now! Please stand by.